from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. San Francisco may become the first city in the country to require that cell phone retailers post how much radiation cell phones emit. The question of whether cell phones represent a potential health hazard has long been contentious and inconclusive. Manufacturers say that since the risks are unproven, the proposal is unnecessary. But proponents argue it's just information consumers should have at their fingertips before their fingertips go to work. In the hour ahead, we'll take up the debate and get the latest on what we know and don't know about cell phones and health hazards. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. Are cell phones hazardous to your health? Do they increase the risk of brain tumors? The answer is, we don't know for sure. That's despite any number of research studies, including a massive 10-year, $25 million World Health Organization-sponsored study which analyzed cell phone usage in 13 countries. That report, published last month, did not find any conclusive links between cell phone usage and brain cancer, but it did suggest that high cell phone usage, defined as 30 minutes of use a day, might be associated with a higher risk of a certain form of brain cancer. Still, researchers said there were just too many variables to conclude a definitive link. So what should you do when the evidence is cloudy and the answer's unclear? Enter the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. A proposal now before that body would require cell phone retailers to display how much radiation cell phones emit right alongside how much they cost. Proponents say it's simply a matter of giving consumers information to make informed choices. Opponents say the proposal is unnecessary because the science is uncertain and the information is already available on a variety of websites. So what makes sense in this sort of circumstance? That's the question we're going to investigate this hour. We're going to hear from a variety of points of views, but joining us first is San Francisco Supervisor Sophie Maxwell, who's leading the push for the new proposal. Supervisor Maxwell, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
As I just mentioned, opponents of this proposal say that, look, the information isn't clear yet, the science isn't clear, and besides, if you really want to know, you can go on the internet and find it out. So given that, outline for me why you think it's necessary for the city to get involved in this debate.
Well, San Francisco adopted some time ago the precautionary principles, which means when in doubt, do the safest thing. And that's what we're doing here. We feel that since the information is collected already by the federal government, that our citizens deserve the right to have that information clear and simple and easy for them to access. And we feel it's a responsibility of our city to protect our citizens and give them as much protection as we can. If they don't need it, fine. If things prove to be okay, but if they don't, then we have done the best that we should do. And that's why I think this is extremely important and I'm pushing for it.
And what – give us the mechanics of how this would actually work. What would this – would this be a giant red flag next to a cell phone? What would consumers who walk into their neighborhood cell phone store actually see if the proposal is enacted?
Well, displayed with all the other information, the price – and all of the amenities that it has, it would give a numerical number of the SARS, which is the specific absorption rate, and it's a numerical measure of cell phone radiation. It varies widely from phone to phone, so therefore it would be important for somebody to know that so that they could make an informed decision. We would also, if this would be next to a sample phone. If there was not a sample phone, then there would be a poster, and it would list this numerical number. It would also list what it means and where you can get more information.
What is your response to the concern that some people would raise is that a number without a lot of context isn't going to necessarily be that helpful, and that people might interpret it the wrong way, might jump to certain conclusions that aren't yet scientifically justified?
Well, that's why we would say exactly what this means and where they can get more information. What we're trying to do here is to give people information so that they can at least think. They can certainly get more information. We're going to tell them where they can get more information. But I think you know, like anything else, this is something new. But once we've done it and once people get the hang of it, I think they will understand that it's better and people will feel better about the products when they know more about them.
One last thought. Why should this be, I guess, a priority for the city at this point? We all know the kinds of budget cuts that cities in San Francisco in particular are now facing, including budget cuts in the Department of Health, who would be tasked with administering this requirement and checking up on whether or not retailers are doing what they're supposed to do. Given those budget cuts, given all the health priorities and larger city priorities that now face San Francisco, why should this be bumped up?
Actually, it's the Department of the Environment.
Okay. What I read was that it would be the Department of Health that would monitor, but it's the Department of the Environment. So again, though, same question. Given those circumstances, given all the pressing needs that the city faces, why should this be a priority?
This is for me?
Yes.
Oh, well, because San Francisco deals with our health, you know, we have Healthy San Francisco, we are really trying to be proactive here. And I think that the way it works is it's information that's already, you know, that we don't have to make. And so I think it's cost-effective for us. It's cost-effective, and the retailers will get the information. What the department does is they will kind of gather information and make it available. But that's basically what it is, and I think it's cost-effective, and I believe the Department of the Environment feels that way. The mayor feels that way. We're trying to be proactive. If we are insuring people, then we have a responsibility to give them as much information so that they can be as healthy as possible. It's cost effective.
But having it be cost effective assumes that there is a known risk.
Well, the precautionary principle. If there is a risk, then we are being proactive. If there's not a risk, then we are still providing the best information that we can.
Last question, Supervisor Maxwell. It's scheduled for a vote, as I understand it, tomorrow. You have the votes?
I believe I do, yes.
All right. Thanks very much, Supervisor Sophie Maxwell. Thanks for getting us started in this discussion. We're joined now by three others who have an active interest in this particular topic. Debbie Rafael is the Toxic Reductions Program Manager for the San Francisco Department of the Environment. Debbie Rafael, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us as well is Daniel Kruski. He's director of the McLaughlin Center for Population Risk Assessment at the University of Ottawa. He was one of the authors of that World Health Organization study on cell phones and brain tumors. Mr. Kruski, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Joel Moskowitz joins us as well, director of the Center for Family and Community Health at the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. Mr. Moskowitz, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's dig in a little bit deeper. Debbie Rafael, first to you. You heard Sophie Maxwell say that this is cost-effective, and I'm curious about that term because that would tend to suggest that putting out this has some benefit in that it would help consumers' health, and yet we don't know if there really is a risk to health. So why is it cost effective?
I think that the reason the supervisor said use the word cost effective is because this information is not that difficult for the retailer to determine. So it's not going to take a lot of effort on the retailer's part to find it. And in terms of the department's role, we have relationships with small businesses across the city, and we have volunteers. We have Jobs Now, which is a stimulus-funded program to get people back to work. We have an army of people on the street who can help us with the information, getting the word out. So in terms of the investment from the city standpoint and the investment from the retail standpoint, it's very small. So the other part of a cost-benefit analysis is the benefit. What is the benefit to getting this information out? The more that the department has learned, the more that the mayor and the supervisors have learned, has made us worry. It's made us wonder, while the science is inconclusive, there is significant evidence of harm that is irreversible. Brain cancer, once you have it, you can't get rid of it. It's not something that you can treat for many of these, for glioma and some of these very serious cancers. So the potential benefit is great to get the information out, and the cost is fairly small.
Debbie Rafael, the Toxic Reduction Program Manager for the San Francisco Department of the Environment. We'll come back and talk more about the specifics of what the San Francisco proposal would actually put in place. But let's pursue this question. Debbie Rafael just said that there's significant evidence of harm or the potential for harm. And I'd like to hear from our scientists this morning their assessment of what we know and whether or not that there is indeed significant risk. Joel Moskowitz, your take.
Sure. In collaboration with a group of researchers from South Korea led by Dr. Myung of the Korean National Cancer Center, our team of researchers at UC Berkeley conducted a review of the studies that examined cell phone use and tumor risk in humans. And this review was published last fall in the Journal of Clinical Oncology. And then, although as a whole the data varied across the studies and it tended to look like nothing was going on, when we sorted out the studies on the basis of either research quality or the nature of the funding, we found distinctly different results. Namely, in the lower quality studies, or the studies that were in part or in whole industry funded, we found what would appear to be protective effects, essentially reduced risk of tumors, especially brain tumors. However, in the studies that were of higher quality or that were solely government-funded, we found overall a significant harmful association with brain tumors particularly and tumors in general. Moreover, in the 13 studies that looked at cell phone use for 10 or more years, we found a significant harmful association with phone use and tumor risk, especially brain tumor risk. Thus, this review of 23 case-control studies created substantial concern amongst our research group about the risk of cell phones.
Let me just jump in and ask you one question about wordage here, because it's key, I think, to understanding sort of what risk is. And you use the word association, which is different, of course, from something causing it. What you're seeing then is that there seems to be an association. You can't tell for sure whether or not it's cell phones that are causing the problem, but there's a relationship. Is that fair to say?
It is a relationship, but these are case control studies, so people are matched. Basically, they take people with brain tumors and then find similar other people coming from the same population who do not have brain tumors, and then look at cell phone use and other exposures that might lead to tumor risk.
Joel Moskowitz, Center for Family and Community Health, School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. Daniel Kruske joins us as well from the McLaughlin Center for Population Health Risk Assessment at the University of Ottawa. He was part of that big World Health Organization study, which looked at cell phone usage over a period of 10 years in 13 different countries. Daniel Kruske, would you agree with what Joel Moskowitz just said about the bulk of the evidence suggests an association?
Well, that's an interesting question in trying to assimilate what really is an enormous body of scientific literature. What is the bottom line? There have literally been, if we look not just at the Interphone study, which is the
that's the big World Health study, right?
That's the big World Health Organization study that you were just describing. There are literally thousands of papers that have been written on the subject of potential health effects of radio frequency fields emitted from wireless telecommunications devices. We have conducted in our center a systematic review for the Public Health Agency of Canada of approximately 50-some epidemiologic studies that have been conducted to date, excluding the Interphone study. We conducted the review prior to those study results being published, and did not find as strong a case as Dr. Moskowitz was finding in his review. But I think when you look at, you raise the question of association versus causality. If we look at studies of human populations, there are a number of criteria that can go from association to causality, and the strength of the association, how big the risk is one. The bigger the risk, the more confident you would feel that there may be a causal relationship. Whether or not there's an increasing risk with increasing level of cell phone utilization, and we don't see such clear evidence of what we call increasing dose response in the cell phone epidemiology literature. And we also would feel more confident about concluding causality if we had a plausible biological mechanism by which we could envisage radio frequency fields inducing cancer. So we could also look to authoritative reviews by the World Health Organization, national, international expert bodies, and just about every group that I've looked at that has evaluated the literature thoroughly has not come to the conclusion that we have firm evidence of an increase health risk associated with radio frequency field exposure.
Well, let's dig into a couple of points that you made. First, in terms of, we should be clear, by the way, on what it is cell phones actually emit. So they emit, as I understand it, a kind of non-ionizing radiation, a bit like a microwave, right, Dr. Kruske? So tell us first what's actually emitted, and then from that, I want to ask about what we know about the kind of risk that kind of radiation might pose.
Well, there's two points that should be made in response to your very excellent question. Let's distinguish between ionizing radiation and non-ionizing radiation. Non-ionizing is a weaker form of radiation that does not have sufficient energy to break chemical bonds and hence is not thought to damage cellular DNA. Ionizing radiation, on the other hand, of the type that you would get when you receive a chest X-ray or a CAT scan, is much stronger and can cause damage to cellular DNA and is hence of greater concern. If we look at what part of the non-ionizing radio frequency spectrum cell phones occupy, it's just above the frequency band for standard AM and FM broadcast radio and also television, and just below the frequencies that your microwave oven operates at. So it's in a portion of the radio frequency spectrum that we're very familiar with.
And is your point that there just isn't any reason to think, there's no biological theory even, let alone evidence to suggest that form of radiation could cause health damage?
Well, I would like to put it so simply, but the Royal Society of Canada did a review of the potential health effects of radio frequency fields about a decade ago. And that group, I did have the honor of serving as panel chair, was the first to actually, I think, go on record and document biological changes as a consequence of exposure to radio frequency fields. For example, the rate at which sodium and calcium ions cross cellular membranes can be altered in the presence of a radio frequency field. I don't want to get too technical, but the induction of enzymes like ornithine decarboxylase can also be caused by RF field exposure. So we do see clear evidence of biological changes in response to RF field exposure. But all of the changes that we've seen to date are of no known clinical significance. So, again, we need to understand these biological changes, but at this point in time, I don't think they provide compelling evidence of an adverse health risk.
Dr. Moskowitz, just staying with that point for a moment, do you concur with that assessment on the kind of radiation that's emitted and the degree to which it does or does not pose a risk?
Well, I don't completely concur. Indeed, it is. The carrier signal is a microwave, but there are digital pulses that operate on top of that wave that may be the culprit here. We just don't know enough about the mechanism. Here, too, with regard to the biological evidence, there's been a review of the research by Dr. Henry Lai at the University of Washington, and I believe he found biologic reactivity in three-quarters of the studies that were not industry-funded, whereas in the industry-funded studies, three-quarters of the studies failed to find biologic reactivity. Some of this reactivity, by the way, is indeed harmful, and there's effects on reproductive system as well as effects on DNA cellular break. This is not my area, so I don't really want to go into that. But here, too, I think there's a fair amount of controversy mm-hmm. with regard to what the literature is actually telling us. And actually, if we go back to the Interphone study, of which our review looked at eight of the component studies, not the final combined data study. But if you look at the recently released combined data study, our reading of that study suggests that there is indeed evidence of dose response kinds of risk with regard to glioma. If one looks at a table that was buried in the second appendix, one sees clearly where you use as the reference group a group of people that have used cell phones for less than 2 years, and you compare them to people who have used their cell phones for longer, you see a dose-response kind of relationship moving up to about more than a doubling of risk in those who have used cell phones for 10 or more years. So in actuality, even though the Interphone study, by the investigator's own admission, was seriously flawed, most of those flaws biased the study against finding risk, and yet you still find significant risk for glioma in two sets of analyses. In addition to the analysis that was buried in the second appendix, In the main body of the paper, there was a 40% increased risk among those, as you had mentioned earlier, who had used cell phones for roughly 30 minutes a day.
Well, let me get into a little more depth on that particular point, and then I want to get Debbie Rafael back into our conversation about the San Francisco proposal. Dr. Kruske, on that last point, glioma, form of brain cancer, brain tumor, and in your study, it did suggest that those who had used cell phones about 30 minutes a day had a 40% had a higher percentage of cases of that disease, 40% higher. Now let's get that number in some context as well, because 40% sounds like a lot. But again, as I understand it, if the chances are 1 in 1,000, a 40% increase would go from 1 to 1.4 in 1,000. So give us some sense of what that means and how we can determine, again, this question of association versus an actual risk that we ought to really be paying attention to.
Well, I'd be happy to help interpret the 40% increased risk in glioma that we reported in the paper. But I wonder if we could go back, Dave, and just talk about the Interphone study, because what you've heard from the two scientists on your panel is the data is complex. It's subject to uncertainty. There are different interpretations by different individuals looking at the current body of scientific evidence. Interphone was actually designed to be the study that would settle the question, do cell phones increase brain cancer risk? And if we go back to 1998, we had a 2-year feasibility study conducted by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, which is part of the World Health Organization, to determine, do we have enough experience with use of cell phones in populations around the world to make the study worthwhile? If there is a risk, it was thought at that point it would probably be small. Can we conduct a study that's large enough to have a chance at identifying a small risk? And if we do such a study, how could we build in the types of quality control mechanisms that would ensure that it's the best possible answer that we could get to the question that we're being asked? We actually went to great pains to make sure that the study was the best it could possibly be. If you were a participant in the Interphone study, we would sit you down, ask you to tell us every cell phone that you ever used throughout your entire life. We'd have a book with pictures and models to help you identify the actual phones. We then ask you how many calls you made a day, how long were you on the phone on average. And then if we were in the U.S., unfortunately the U.S. was not part of the study, we would ask your permission to go to your service provider and check your cell phone billing records and see how accurate your recall was. We gave a group of individuals so-called software-modified smartphones that actually tracked their cell phone usage in real time to compare against their recall. The smartphones also monitored power output levels. There were a whole series of questions related to potential factors that might obfuscate the relationship between cell phone utilization and brain cancer risk, including detailed occupational histories in 3 of the 13 countries. So,
Dr. Kruske, I'm sorry to interject, but we're coming up on a phone break. We're coming up on a station break, and so I need to hold you there. I promise we'll come back and let you explain the way in which the study was conducted, and then we'll dig in deeper to this question of what we know and don't know about risk, and we'll hear more about what the city of San Francisco is considering, the kind of labeling that will take place, and why the city is feeling at this moment that that might be an appropriate thing for the city to embark upon. We want your questions, too, and your views on this issue. You can join us now at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, cell phones and health hazards. The city of San Francisco is poised to become the first city in the country that would require cell phone retailers to post information about the kind of radiation that cell phones emit right alongside how much they cost. The Board of Supervisors is scheduled to vote on that proposal tomorrow. Joining us to talk about that topic, Debbie Rafael, who is the Toxic Reductions Program Manager for the San Francisco Department of the Environment. That's the department that would be tasked with putting this proposal into action. Daniel Kruske joins us as well. He's with the McLaughlin Center for Population Health Risk at the University of Ottawa. He was part of the World Health Organization's Big Phone Study, sometimes called the Interphone Study, on this. And Joel Moskowitz joins us as well. He's the director of the Center for Family and Community Health at the University of California, Berkeley. We welcome your thoughts on this subject. What are your concerns about health phone risks? Do you think it makes sense for the city of San Francisco to go forward with some sort of labeling information that consumers would then be able to take advantage of? Here's the number if you'd like to participate in our conversation. It's 866-733-6786. You can also email us at forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and add in your comment online. Dr. Kruske, back to you. You were finishing a complete summary of how you went about doing this research, which I appreciate. Don't mean to cut you off on that. But if you could also get to this question of risk, because again, when you hear the data that there is a 40% increase in risk of glioma, serious form, obviously, of brain cancer, sounds scary.
Well, I may have gone into a little bit too much detail, but the bottom line was we wanted to demonstrate that this was a unusually well-conducted study with great attention to making sure everything was done to the highest possible quality standards.
And I'm sorry, before I'm now going to preempt myself, but you should also respond to one thing, because Dr. Moskowitz has brought up a couple of times that studies that have been supported by the industry have come up with results that he's more suspect of. We should note that there was industry money in this study. Can you tell us whether or not that in any way affected the kind of results that you came up with?
Yeah, this is a very important question that really should be clarified. Roughly 50% of the approximately $25 million cost of the study, I think, came from the private sector. But through the funding that went directly to WHO was through a third party, the UICC, the Union Internationale Contre le Cancer. They received the money from the industry, set up an independent scientific advisory body to govern the transfer of the funds then to the WHO, to the investigators primarily in Europe, and the industry actually had no involvement once they had provided the funding to UICC. In fact, they were not permitted to interact with the team nor see any of the results until the paper was finally published in the peer-reviewed literature.
And to the point now on the glioma brain cancer risk.
If you look at the 10 categories of cell phone utilization in the Interphone study based on cumulative call time, so we broke the respondents up into the bottom 10%, the next 10%, and the highest 10%, which was more than 1,640 cumulative call hours, which works out, as you pointed out, to about an average of 30 minutes a day, low cell phone utilization by today's standards. There was a relative risk of 1.4 of glioma, and that relative risk actually became adjusted to 1.8, so a 40 to 80% increase, actually, if you take into account some of the errors that we were characterizing in the study. So what it really means, if you have a small risk, as you point out, of background risk of brain cancer, the strict interpretation of the number, it would go up by 40%. The international study team was not willing to conclude that that was a causal association because some of the individuals in that high-dose group, high-exposure group, reported implausibly high values of cell phone utilization. It's not clear that would have taken them out of that group if we knew the true values, but the data were a little bit suspect, and we also had to contend with other sources of uncertainty. So the finding was taken as suggestive, but not definitive.
And Debbie Rafael, as you listen to this conversation and how complex it really is to come to any kind of clear determination of what the risks are, walk through us then, given that murky terrain in which we exist, why it's important for the city to take a proactive stance.
Thank you for that question. You know, as I sit here listening to these two very learned people talk about how much effort has gone into studying this issue and the integrity of the studies, but the challenges of the interpretation of that data, I'm left as a parent and as a consumer very perplexed, because this is serious stuff. This is brain cancer. And we're talking in the U.S. of an average use of 30 minutes per day. That's the average use right now in the U.S. And yet in that Interphone study, that was the heavy use. That's where effects were found. Furthermore, what worries me as I listen to this discussion is...
Well, again, just to be clear, yeah, it's not clear that effects were found. It's what's been determined.
Okay, but if I'm that one person with brain cancer, you know, yes.
Yeah.
Of course, absolutely, we cannot prove cause and effect today. And we have a long history of waiting too long to take action while we wait for proof of cause and effect.
So your point would simply be, look, there's a possibility, even if that's all we can say, there's a possibility, then it's worth consumers having enough information to make an informed choice.
That's a beautiful summary. That's exactly what we're saying. And furthermore, the important to children. I'd love to, at some point today, talk about that.
We will come back to that because some of the standards are based on what an adult male would absorb, and we don't know much about what this means for children. And as we all know, children increasingly use cell phones a lot. All right, let's hear from some of our listeners and their concerns on this question. Caroline in San Jose joins us first. Caroline, go ahead, please.
In many of the studies, I hear a lot about these studies, but no one, I haven't heard any studies involving a headset. Is any of the health issues and brain or potential cancers also attributed if someone uses a headset? Has there any been study around that is what I was wondering.
Caroline, thanks. Dr. Moskowitz, you want to take that?
I'm not aware of any studies that have specifically looked at the use of a headset, and for one, it would take a long time to establish that that was the safe way to go. But based on the physics of electromagnetic fields and radiation, that is what we've been recommending. In fact, we published an op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle on April 28th based on our review, and that was one of the things we recommended was that people consider using headsets, speaker phones, keeping the phone away from your body. And in fact, if you look in the manuals to most phones, if you dig far enough, for example, my wife bought a phone, page 219 of the manual, which we had to download, which took me several communications with the cell phone manufacturer as well as the telecommunications company to find out about, it said that the phone should be kept 15 millimeters away from the body at all times when it's in use.
Well, it's a really interesting point, Debbie Rafael, because I didn't know this until I started reading up on this last night. But T-Mobile says, for example, you should keep your phone an inch away from your ear, an iPhone 5/8 of an inch, a BlackBerry an inch. So that seems to be a pretty consistent recommendation. And yet, if you walk around today, I would bet that you're not going to find anyone holding their phone an inch away from their ear.
And that point gets to one of the things you opened with, and that is simply putting the SAR value, which is the level of radiation next to the phone, is not sufficient. What we really need is an education program, is an education effort on a national scale to let people know how to reduce their risk of exposure to this potential harm.
And Dr. Kruske, given all of the complexity that you have outlined for us in interpreting these results, do you concur, though, that it makes sense, given what little we definitively know, to still follow certain sorts of precautions, using a headset, using speakerphone, keeping it an inch away from your ear? Do those sort of common sense steps, are they common sense, I guess?
Well, they are common sense, and I am sympathetic to the use of the precautionary principle for risk management decision-making when there's significant uncertainty. But in this case, I'm not sure that the science actually warrants that we mandate precaution. It may be something that we could advise people on and let them make personal risk management decisions. The field strength is greatest at the tip of the antenna, which is typically built into most phones now, the flip phones that we used to have in the past when you extended the antenna. Got the field strength a little bit away from the head. But if you're using a headset, the exposure to the head and neck area is essentially zero. If you're using a Bluetooth headpiece, it is much lower power output levels than a conventional cell phone. So those are two things that you can do to reduce your exposure. There's mandated use of hands-free units in automobiles in many states and provinces now, which would further reduce exposure. And you can also use the phone a little bit less if you're personally concerned.
And let's hear from more of our listeners and their concerns. Caroline in Walnut Creek joins us next. Caroline, go ahead.
Hi. I'm from Switzerland. I'm a Swiss-American, and I lived in Switzerland for 25 years. And recently in July, I spoke with a cancer specialist in the Alps. And he had spoken to me about what's going on in Europe regarding this whole thing. Now, there were two comments I wanted to make. One is that the Interphone study, which is interesting, America didn't take part. I wanted to know why and what's going on there. Secondly, why was an industry-backed study stopped at 10 years when Europeans have done studies at 15 years where it's very conclusive and they are actually being very proactive and banning telephones for children? Obviously, the Russian National Committee came out with a report on 2008, and they emphasized ultimate urgency to defend children's health.
Caroline, let me hold your question. You've raised some good points about the difference, perhaps, between standards in the States and in Europe, and also about why the length of a 10-year study versus longer. Dr. Kruske, can you respond?
Well, there was also a question about why the U.S. was not involved in Interphone.
Right.
The funding that was provided by WHO was restricted to European countries. Outside of Europe, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Japan all had to secure funding from national granting agencies. So in Canada, we went to Canadian Institutes for Health Research for funding. I believe that the U.S. Did attempt to secure funding from domestic sources, but was unsuccessful, and that's the reason that we don't have U.S. participation in the study.
And on the question of European standards being different and why not doing things for longer?
Well, I can explain the protocol for the Interphone study and why it took the length of time that it did. We started with a 2-year feasibility study, as I mentioned, 1998 and 99. The protocol called for 5 years of data collection in the field, which is a long period of time for an epidemiologic study. And then we had a period of over a year of data analysis, and then the final period in that 10-year time frame was the actual interpretation of a complex data set by an international study team that included 22 investigators. And we went through a number of drafts until we got it as right as we could. At some point, Dave, I would like to make a comment on children, but I'll let you decide when that should enter the conversation.
Now is good. Debbie Rafael brought that up earlier, and it's an important point because the studies that your study took a look at were focused on adults. Walk us through what we know or don't know about kids at this point.
Well, we don't know a lot about children. The epidemiology has focused largely on adults. There are exposure studies showing that children could have higher energy deposition levels because of the smaller tissue mass and in the head area that the field is being exposed to. But if we look at research needs, just about every body that's looked at additional research needs, and we do need further research, has identified children as a major data gap and a high priority. The U.S. National Research Council produced a report about a year and a half ago on research priorities for radio frequency fields and health, and a large-scale epidemiologic study was the first of 10 major recommendations that were made. I can tell you that there is a new study similar to Interphone. It's called MobiKids, which is just getting started in Europe. So that will be very much in response to that research need, but it's going to take at least 5 years before we have the results of that study.
And Dr. Moskowitz, anything you want to add in terms of what's known about the health impacts on children, but also suggestions that you'd make for parents who might be listening about what their kids ought to do or not do?
As Dr. Kruske said, we have very little data on children. I think the only result I've seen is some data that Dr. Hardell in Sweden collected. He showed a fourfold risk of brain tumors, but it was a very, very small sample. So we clearly need to learn a lot more about children. But I think we need to get better investigators doing this work and totally eliminate any industry funding to remove even the appearance of a conflict of interest. Despite all the precautions taken with regard to the Interphone study, the study was botched, basically. And I think some of those problems could have been anticipated by and would have been anticipated by other epidemiologists and could have easily been fixed. The selection bias was huge in that study. The failure to assess carefully and control for cordless phone use, which is believed to also be a risk for tumors, seems to be negligent on the part of the Interphone investigators.
All right, I don't really want to take a lot more of our precious remaining time on the protocols of the research, but given that you just said it was negligent and botched, I do need to give Dr. Kruske the opportunity for a brief, if you could please, response.
I'll be brief, Dave. We did, as I said earlier, try to anticipate a number of these potential issues and did side studies to try and gauge the magnitude of different errors. We did look at selection bias. We followed up with the non-respondents, and we are able to make adjustments for most of the major errors. Those are not explicit in the original paper. But don't forget, we're going to be working on interphone data for several years, and one of the most exciting papers that we hope to produce, we have information on the point of origin of the tumor in the brain area that the radiologist provide us with. And we also have energy deposition maps for the head and neck area, so we can get a much finer measure of exposure in relation to the point of origin for the tumor. So there's still much to come from the interphone study is my message.
Let's get some listener queries responded to, if we can. Karen writes in, will the city of San Francisco just be posting information about cell phones? What about the effects of Bluetooth devices? Mm. Debbie Rafael?
Well, I'd sure like to know more about Bluetooth devices. The reason we chose cell phones, and so the quick answer is no, it won't deal with Bluetooth, and that's because there is no requirement for the manufacturers of Bluetooth to notify the federal government of the radiation emissions coming out of them. So if there's one thing, well, there's many things we hope to accomplish. One of the things that would be great from this ordinance is to really kick off a national discussion on the limits of our knowledge, the limits of the U.S.'s participation in these studies, and maybe we can start to get some information on Bluetooth as well.
I should have mentioned, by the way, earlier that we did invite wireless industry representatives to be a part of our program, both from the trade group CTIA and AT&T California, but both of those organizations declined to participate in our conversation this morning. Here's another listener comment. It seems strange to me that labeling our ever-present cell phones would be an issue at all. Why is it that industry is reluctant to supply us with this basic information? I guess the answer is, Debbie, the information is there. It just takes some work to find it, and you want to make that information more available.
Exactly. So that question gets exactly to the heart of the issue. Why is there so much pushback on this ordinance? The information is there, but it is so hard to get. And we know that consumers want easy access and that they just want it to be as easy to find the radiation value as it is the price.
Here's a question from Rick about San Francisco's priorities. Why is it that San Francisco cannot solve the homeless problem and has unexamined rape kits dating back for years, has cut the budget for the city crime lab, but now they want to focus on this particular issue?
So that's a fair question, and I honestly don't have an answer for why we haven't solved all the ills of the city. So for me, the bottom line is it's an and, not an or. We need to work on all of those things.
In the time that we have, and we'll get back to more of our listener comments in a moment, I guess I want to just dig down a little bit deeper on this question of how we perceive risk. If you look at some of the headlines, Dr. Moskowitz, accompanying the Interphone or World Health Organization study, you found things like this from the Associated Press. Study on cell phone link to cancer inconclusive. But then you also saw this from the Globe and Mail in Canada. Heavy use of cell phones may increase tumor risk. Or you might find a headline that says, from the Guardian in the UK, mobile phone use finds no link to brain cancer tumors. So we're all over the place with this. The press is, consumers are. Dr. Moskowitz, how do you sort that out?
Well, it's very difficult. And I think the Interphone investigators had a difficult time sorting it out, and that's why it took them an extra 4 or so years to get the paper into print, because the group is indeed divided. If you read some of the media coverage from some of the investigators, they're clearly arguing for precautionary warnings. Others are saying that the study was inconclusive, we can make no recommendations. And then there's a third group that's saying there's no evidence of risk. So the investigators are totally divided. I think it may actually break down in terms of their conflicts of interest. To end with regard to funding, either through other sources to industry, but it may also involve other data that they're aware of outside of Interphone. But if one reads the paper carefully, as we did, I think one can make a pretty strong argument for, yeah, overall it's inconclusive, but there seems to be a substantial amount of evidence, and they bent over backwards to demonstrate that some of those analyses, for example, the 40% risk, which Dr. Kruske said when you adjust it properly is an 80% increase risk, they presented 44 different analyses in the paper to try to refute some of the alternative explanations for that risk. So it seems to me to be a causal phenomenon.
Well, let's hear. A listener puts this question interestingly, and Dr. Kruske, like your response to it. Dr. Kruske's summary of how studies are conducted is important. It's complex, and it's not enough attention is paid to it. People want simple answers. Are cell phones hazardous or not? But risk has two factors, likelihood and severity. Even if it's not likely that cell phones are hazardous, brain cancer would be a really severe risk. And therefore, the precautionary principle should be emphasized. It's a sort of logical way to sort through this. Yes, Dr. Kruske?
Well, I'd like to make two points that I don't know if they confront your question head on, Dave. But my two points are, you've already observed that if you look at the media coverage on this issue, the Interphone study, which has been extensive, it's been all over the map. No risk, increased risk. Inconclusive. So how does the public make sense of that? And it's almost embarrassing for me as a scientist to have spent 12 years of my life and been involved in a $25 million study and still have some ambiguity. But having said that, there are several messages which I think are very helpful in interpreting the Interphone results. First, the finding of no overall increase in risk, I think, is reassuring. It suggests that we don't have a severe epidemic of brain cancer on our hands in relation to RF exposure from wireless telecommunications devices. Second, we do see this hint, a suggestion of an increased risk in glioma, which we're not able to determine is conclusive at this point, and we are recommending further research be done. And third, if we look at research priorities, everybody is really pointing to children as the area where we need to work on.
But would you agree with the bottom line of our last listener email, which is essentially, even if we don't know anything definitively, at this point in time, it just makes sense to be smart about this.
I think we can be smart in very effective ways. The headsets reduce your exposure to essentially zero. The Bluetooth headsets, as I said earlier, much lower power output levels. So there are things that we can do if you're concerned about the risk to reduce exposure.
And back to our callers. Larry in San Francisco has a question. Larry, go ahead.
Hi, Mike. The use of the cell phone when it's not in use. Say you do use it 30 minutes a day. What about the other 12 hours that it sits along your body? What kind of, medical problems that maybe you have any input on there?
Great question, Larry. Thank you. What about that, Dr. Moskowitz?
I think taking a precautionary approach, one should be concerned about potential risk, particularly the reproductive organs. There is laboratory evidence indicating effects on sperm from cell phones. So it's best to keep it away from the body, keep it in a purse away from the body as much as you can, keep the antenna away from your body as much as you can, keep the phone off. Do you really need to have the phone on 24/7? Can you just use it like an answering machine and just check your messages every once in a while by turning it on?
A common sense recommendation that I bet most of our listeners are not going to follow. But, one of our emailers just emailed in, Dr. Moskowitz, should men carry their cell phones in their pocket? And based on what you just said about reproductive organs, the answer sounds like, from your point of view at least, that they should not.
I've been trying not to do that since we did this study. And I came into the study as a total skeptic, so I was quite surprised with our findings. So I've been taking much more precaution with regard to my cell phone by not keeping it on my body. I keep it on my desk during the day, and I often keep it off when I'm going about.
We should begin to bring this to a close with your assessments both on risk and what consumers ought to do. Someone is emailing in, Tommy emails in, Debbie Raffel, that cell phone emissions information is listed on the FCC website. However, it's very difficult to find since it's not under a single web page. You can go to the CNET, the tech site, CNET.com, and find information about specific cell phones there. If you don't live in the city of San Francisco, assuming this actually does go into effect, what else can you tell us about how consumers can find out information?
Yeah, there's a great website that I'd love to suggest people go to, and that's the Environmental Working Group, EWG.org. They have done a phenomenal job of making a user-friendly interface for people to find out their cell phone radiation. So if you don't live in San Francisco, or if you just want to go right now and find out how your cell phone measures up, go to EWG.org, and they have a wonderful amount of information on cell phones, including the kinds of things you can do to to reduce your exposure.
And Dr. Moskowitz, a last quick thought on what you think consumers should do right now. Just briefly, if you would, please.
I think people need to get more political around this issue and start raising the consciousness of our legislators. I mean, I think it's abysmal that the United States didn't participate in the Interphone study. We've just been really asleep at the switch in terms of regulation, in terms of research on this issue. There's at least 9 other nations that have issued precautionary warnings to their people. We need to really wake up our policymakers on this issue and learn what's really happening to us in this massive experiment.
And Dr. Daniel Kruski.
Well, I think we need to take some comfort in the huge body of scientific evidence that we already have, which is to a large extent reassuring. At the same point, there are some concerns that still need to be addressed, and I will point for the last time today to the need for further studies of children's use of mobile phones.
And Debbie Rafael, assuming that the San Francisco Board of Supervisors goes forward with this vote tomorrow, how long will it take before this ordinance then would go into effect?
We were very concerned about the impact on our small business in San Francisco, and so what consumers will see is a rollout that will depend on the size of the business. So the beginning of in February of next year, the large retailers, the Best Buys, the Apple stores, the AT&T stores, you'll see those SAR values there. The very smaller retailers, we're going to give them another year to work on it.
Deborah Fell, the Toxic Reductions Program Manager for the San Francisco Department of the Environment. We're also joined this hour by Daniel Kruski, the Director of the McLaughlin Center for Population Risk Assessment at the University of Ottawa, and Joel Moskowitz, Director of the Center for Family and Community Health at the School of Public Health at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks all very much for participating in our program. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Kevin Guillory. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer this hour is Danny Bringer. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Dave Iverson, and this is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.